This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, is a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict still possible? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. On the sidelines of the annual United Nations General Assembly, U.S. President Donald Trump said that he endorsed a two-state solution and would be releasing a peace plan within 4 months. President Trump's backing of a two-state solution, a concept that has undergirded efforts of U.S. administrations for decades, was a shift from a previous stance in which he said he would back either one or two states, whichever the two sides decided between themselves. However, longtime regional observers say that some of the administration's recent actions have not been conducive for the resumption of talks. Analysts say moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, ceasing funding for the U.N. Relief and Works Agency, or UNRWA, which supports Palestinian refugees, and ordering the closure of the Palestinian diplomatic mission in Washington actually hinder rather than hasten resumption of peace talks. Taken together, experts say these unilateral moves amount to punitive actions that may in fact undermine Washington's traditional position as an impartial mediator to the conflict. Well, on this edition of Encounter, we'll discuss the many obstacles to and possible incentives for resuming talks on a two-state solution with two distinguished Middle East analysts. Khaled El-Gindi is a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and that's a Washington-based think tank. He is also a founding board member of the Egyptian-American Rule of Law Association. Previously, he served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership in Ramallah on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009. And David Pollack, he's senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and that's a think tank also based here in Washington. A former U.S. diplomat, David Pollack is also the director of Project Fikra, designed to generate policy ideas for promoting positive change and countering the spread of extremism in the Middle East. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Khaled El-Gindi, you used to work with the Palestinians as a negotiator. On this, the 25th anniversary of the Oslo Accords that created the framework for peace over the last three decades, how do you assess prospects for a two-state solution? Is it still possible?
I think this has to be one of the lowest points in what has been termed the Middle East peace process. I don't think prospects have been worse for peace than where we are now. And that's actually saying quite a bit. I was among those who, even before Trump entered the White House, who was saying that effectively the peace process was already dead. And it died a slow death, but I think it really did die on President Obama's watch. And where we are today is really in a post-Oslo era. And Trump's declaration on Jerusalem, the embassy move, and the many other sanctions that have been posed on the Palestinians by this administration, I think are an indication of that in very clear, stark terms that we're no longer in the Oslo period. And it's not even really clear that a two-state solution is physically possible on the ground.
Turning to you, David Pollack, are we indeed in a post-Oslo era, as Khaled El-Gindi said? Is the two-state solution dead, do you think, despite Mr. Trump's recent reversal on his position with respect to a two-state solution?
Well, I do think that we're in a post-Oslo period, but that's not the same as saying that the peace process is over or that a two-state solution is impossible. We're in a new phase, and I think that a two-state solution, ultimately, difficult as it certainly has become, is still not impossible. And the reason I say that is in part because even President Trump just this week has returned to the idea that a two-state solution, as he put it, will probably work best. Hard as it is, both sides, the Palestinians and the Israelis, at the official level, the government level, and at the popular level, still see a two-state solution of some kind as the least bad long-term alternative.
Well, back to you, Khaled El-Gindi, to talk about some obstacles to that very two-state solution that you alluded to. You said even physically on the ground, it's becoming more and more difficult. Talk about first Mr. Trump's recent moves, particularly the move of the American embassy to Jerusalem. What other obstacles do you see? And to what extent do you think these actually help move the goalpost further away from a potential solution?
Yeah, they clearly do move the goalposts away. I don't think there's any political leadership in the world, in any conflict setting, that would enter a peace process on the basis of essentially bullying and heavy-handedness and threats and coercion. Most diplomacy involves some carrots and some sticks. What we've seen, of course, from Trump really are massive carrots for Israel, recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital, taking the refugee issue off the table, expelling the PLO from Washington. These are huge strategic-level carrots for Israel. And at the same time, massive sticks for the Palestinians. You know, when I say it's the end of the Oslo process, it's the end of an American-led peace process. A two-state solution, I agree, is sort of the least worst option that people can come up with. It hasn't worked out. I think it's highly unlikely given the political configuration that we have all the way around. But even if it were possible, theoretically, it's really no longer possible for the United States to play the kind of role that it has. And so there's really not much hope that a Palestinian leadership will come back to the negotiating table on the terms of what Donald Trump has laid out. There's no longer any such thing as a U.S.-led peace process.
Turning back to you, David Pollack, to the point that Khaled El-Gindi makes that it's perceived by many actors, and particularly the Palestinians, that the United States, with these unilateral moves, is no longer seen as an honest broker. It wasn't seen sometimes before that, but particularly now with moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, something that was supposed to be decided in final status talks. And Mr. Trump preempted that with his action and a number of other actions that we've already delineated. How do you reconcile your optimism with these concrete moves on the ground that sort of contradict what is needed for resumption of talks?
It's a fair question, but I do want to say, don't call me an optimist. I am not optimistic that there will be peaceful settlement of this conflict anytime soon. All I'm saying is that eventually, I think there's still a chance for a peaceful solution based on some kind of two-state formula. Now, let me turn to the Jerusalem issue. Here I disagree completely with the notion that recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital and moving the U.S. embassy has somehow taken the bigger issue of Jerusalem as a whole, quote unquote, off the table. I don't think that's true at all. In fact, the very announcement that President Trump made back in December about recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital explicitly stated that the future status of the whole city remains to be negotiated between the two parties, and that this would not prejudice the outcome of those negotiations. And in fact, from all of the leaks and rumors that we hear about Trump's peace plan in the making, I think there's every reason to believe that part of that peace plan will be to say that some of the predominantly Palestinian neighborhoods or areas of the whole city of Jerusalem should be under Palestinian sovereignty, not Israeli sovereignty, in the future, as part of a negotiated final status or peace arrangement.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Khaled El-Gindi, he's a fellow in the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and David Pollack, from whom you just heard. He's senior fellow and director of Project Fikra at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. And on this 25th anniversary of the signing of the Oslo Accords, which laid out a blueprint for a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, we are discussing what may have gone wrong and if such an objective is still indeed possible. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available at our website, voanews.com/encounter. Well, here's a shout-out to Mohammed Nima Batali from Babura in Jigawa State, Nigeria. Thanks for listening and for writing in. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion. Khaled, let me get back to you to talk about Israel now and Israel's moves or lack thereof that may be an obstacle for the two-state solution. And I'm referring to, for example, Israel's recent passage of what is called the Nation-State Bill or the Nationality Bill, which specifies the nature of the state of Israel as the nation-state of the Jewish people. And even though that may seem to be a given, nonetheless, it met with worldwide criticism, including from many in the Jewish diaspora, because it appears to sort of downplay or downgrade the status of Israeli Arabs, downgrade the status of Arabic, which is actually a language of many of the Jews from the Arab lands. To what extent did this law further sort of undermine prospects for talks, continued settlement building? How do you see the Israeli perspective and their moves?
I think the nation-state law is, on the one hand, a sign of Israeli triumphalism. There is a sense in this very hard right-wing, pro-settlement, anti-two-state solution governing coalition in Israel that they won. The Zionist project is victorious over the Palestinian national project. And the icing on the cake is the nation-state law. But I think it's important also just to go back to the question on the peace process and how we got here. One important factor that so many analysts and policymakers quite remarkably overlook is this dynamic of power. So this isn't just a conflict between two national groups. Yes, it is that. But it's also an occupation where one national group is occupying the other. And so there is this huge asymmetry in power. And so the role of a peace process has to be somehow to address that power imbalance. And that's where the U.S. has failed repeatedly. It has consistently put its thumb on the scale on behalf of the stronger party to give Israel assurances that they could keep the settlement blocks. President George W. Bush promised the Israelis that they wouldn't have to withdraw completely, that the refugees would never return. And so what Trump is doing really is part of a pattern of American, quote-unquote, mediation in which the mediator weighs in consistently on behalf of the stronger party. And so this is why the recognition of Jerusalem matters quite a bit, because Israel controls all of Jerusalem, including the eastern portion that is, under international law, occupied territory. So by conferring legitimacy, as vague as it was, over Israeli sovereignty, over any part of Jerusalem, the Israelis will naturally take that as affirmation of their right to control all of Jerusalem. So power matters, and what we do in the context of those power dynamics matters regardless of whether what the specific words were stated or weren't stated. But the real problem with the two-state solution isn't just Israeli settlements, which are expanding at an exponential rate, but the fact that a political consensus for the two-state solution that has allowed that possibility to remain on the table for the past 15 or 20 years is collapsing. You have an Israeli government, as I said, that is not interested in a two-state solution. Netanyahu, when he talks about a Palestinian state, talks about a state with no sovereignty. So they've stripped the idea of a two-state solution of its meaning. And here in the United States, the consensus has also collapsed. The Republican Party officially opposes a two-state solution, which may be why Trump took him almost 2 years to half-heartedly endorse a two-state solution. But that's the real reason that I think a two-state solution won't happen, is that the political will for it isn't there, in addition to the realities on the ground.
So, David Pollack, please respond to Khaled El-Ghindi. Sure. With respect to this lack of political will, notwithstanding a lot of nice words, and the power dynamic, that we're not just talking about two national groups, but really this asymmetry of power.
Yeah, that's all true. I actually agree with almost all of that. But again, both sides, I think, despite the asymmetries and despite the problems, still haven't come up with a better alternative for either one of them. Nor has the United States come up with a better alternative in the long run of, in effect, partitioning historic Palestine between a Jewish state and a Palestinian Arab state. So we are in a situation of an asymmetry of power, but in my own view, that's precisely the reason why a realistic approach to solving the conflict has to work with that reality, and why, in fact, the Palestinian National Movement, after many years, said that it would accept a two-state solution on the 1967 boundaries, not reclaiming all of historic Palestine for a Palestinian state. Not Hamas, unfortunately, but a large number of Palestinians based on public opinion polls and the Palestinian government in Ramallah. And that, of course, reflects an asymmetry of power. But that just means the reality.
Let me turn now to Khaled El-Ghindi to talk in the few minutes we have left about some of the obstacles on the Palestinian side. David Pollack did allude to that. We have Fatah in the West Bank. You have Hamas in Gaza, who's much less amenable to a two-state solution. You have a disarray in the leadership in the Palestinian territories, perceptions of corruption, mismanagement. What could the Palestinians do to deal with the current landscape to improve their prospects?
Yeah, I mean, as you said, I think this is one of the major obstacles to reaching a two-state solution, and one that hasn't been addressed by the peace process. And I would argue, in many ways, the peace process has exacerbated the dysfunctional state of Palestinian politics. Obviously, we have a divided Palestinian leadership, Hamas de facto authority in Gaza. In the West Bank, you have Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. One interesting thing to note, however, is that in terms of the Palestinian political parties and factions, most of them have signed on to what is essentially a two-state solution, including Hamas. It doesn't recognize Israel, but it has accepted the idea of a state in the West Bank and Gaza with East Jerusalem as its capital. And there is broad consensus politically among factions. Of course, it's one thing to state that in theory, the realities on the ground are very different. Settlements are continuing. The United States isn't really engaged or credible in terms of pursuing that. And the Israelis are not interested, frankly. Why would Israelis voluntarily divide Jerusalem and hand over sovereignty over some of the most important parts of Jerusalem to Palestinian sovereignty? It would only do that if it's somehow forced, if it has an incentive, positive or negative, to do that. And the peace process has never been about forcing Israel to do anything. And so that has promoted this triumphalism on the Israeli side, but also the dysfunction on the Palestinian side. And so, yes, Palestinians are divided and dysfunctional, and that's one of the key reasons why there can't be a credible negotiation process.
Do you see any prospects for a reconciliation? There was talk about reconciliation between Hamas and Fatah, I mean, because that could really advance their chances.
Yes, it would, certainly. And I think it would also help alleviate the disastrous humanitarian situation in Gaza if you could bring the Palestinian Authority back and somehow lift the restrictions on Gaza and the blockade. But the reality is that both leaderships, Hamas and Fatah, now have a vested interest in maintaining this division and have no incentive to end it. And that's one of the ways I think the peace process has failed. It didn't create it, but it certainly allowed it to stay in place by sanctioning past efforts for Palestinians to reconcile.
So, David Pollack, with your finger on the pulse, particularly of Israel, what do you think the Palestinians could or should do at this point, you know, if they could reconcile, to assuage any concerns on the government side? And we know that the government is much more right-wing than some Israeli citizens. Yeah. What could they do that could advance this two-state solution?
First, let me say that I disagree completely about the Hamas position here. Hamas does not accept a two-state solution.
But
it never has.
It.
No, not a two-state solution, which means solving the problem, which means peace with Israel. Hamas does not accept that, has never accepted that, and will never accept that.
And neither do most Israeli ministers in this governing coalition.
I agree. But that doesn't excuse or explain away the Hamas rejection of peace with Israel. That has not changed ever, and I see absolutely no reason to think that it will change. And I agree with you, Khaled, that Hamas has, as you said, a vested interest in perpetuating the division of Palestinians because that enables it to control Gaza. And I agree that that is one of the main obstacles to a peace settlement. Now, I do think that it's unfair to ask the Palestinians what they can do to convince the Israeli government that it should make concessions, because this Israeli government doesn't want to make concessions. I agree with you about that as well. But if the Palestinians want to convince Israeli voters that a different Israeli government would actually be well advised to reach a compromise with the Palestinians in order to make peace, not with Hamas, which will never make peace with Israel, but at least with the Palestinian government in the West Bank, the Palestinian Authority, the legitimate government of the Palestinians, then there are a few things that the Palestinians could do, because this serves their interests and serves their legitimate aspirations for sovereignty and self-determination and statehood. What are those things? Number one, the Palestinian government could recognize that Israel is the homeland of the Jewish people. They have never been willing to say that, and I don't understand why. Because if they say that, that will surely help the Israeli people believe that the Palestinians have come around to accepting the legitimacy of Israel and the idea of peace with Israel. And that, in turn, will encourage the Israelis to make concessions over Jerusalem, over territory, over many other issues. And second, the Palestinian government can stop its policy, the one in Ramallah, of paying terrorists. And again, I don't understand why they won't do that, because the Israelis, time and again, and the American government is telling them, if you do that, you are hurting your own long-term interests, because you are demonstrating to the Israelis, not just the Israeli government, but the Israeli public, and to the American public, that you still believe that violence and terrorism and what you call armed struggle against Israelis, including murdering innocent civilians, is one of the ways that you intend to accomplish your political objectives.
Quick response from you, and because we have to wrap up the show.
You know, what David pointed out in terms of reassuring the Israeli public, I think this has been the failed logic of the Oslo process all along. And that is, if we can just assure Israelis that they can take risks for peace, give them the military, political, moral assurances that they need to feel secure, that they will make those concessions necessary for peace. And that simply never panned out. The Bush administration gave the Israelis all kinds of assurances. Even President Obama gave Israel
withdrew from Gaza.
$38 billion.
Sharon pulled Israel out of Gaza.
Because he got assurances over Jerusalem and the refugees and the borders and the settlement blocks.
Assurances to Israel do produce Israeli concessions to the Palestinians.
No, that's not what produced. The withdrawal from Gaza had nothing to do with moving toward a two-state solution. It had to do with trading off the Gaza Strip, which was a liability for the Israelis, for the West Bank and Jerusalem.
But it got Israel out of the business of controlling 2 million Palestinians.
But let me just finish this point. This idea that Israel, the stronger party, needs to be reassured constantly hasn't panned out. The reality is that by giving Israel all those assurances and all the weapons, it has said there is no price to pay for the occupation. There's no price in financial terms. There's no price in political or diplomatic terms. So why should I do anything? And so letting Israel off the hook, not holding Israel accountable for any, not excessive use of force against Palestinian civilians, not for settlement building. To the contrary, Israel gets rewarded. Even President Obama, who was not particularly close to the Israeli prime minister, signed the largest aid deal in American history. So all of that tells Israel there is no price for continuing the status quo. You need a strong Palestinian interlocutor, but you also need an Israeli power that is held accountable. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
One more last word to you, David Pollack, before we wrap up the show.
I think, as you said before, Khalid, you need both assurances to Israel and a price for Israel to pay for continuing its occupation.
But there's never been one.
I don't agree with that, because the Israelis have withdrawn from the occupation of Gaza. And that demonstrates that they accept assurances and they recognize a price that they have to pay and they behave accordingly.
And of course, both of you demonstrate why it is so hard for to reach compromise on this very important and intractable problem. But I'm afraid for now, at least, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Khalid El-Ghindi. He's with the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, and David Pollack, Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Encounter was produced in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.